Our main speaker is Robert Kay.
Hi, everybody. My name is Robert Kilgore, and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank Charlie for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope this evening. I'd like to welcome our new friends who raised their hands. As newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to welcome you here. I sincerely hope that you're miserable. I hope that you're losing your home, your car is dented, and the wife is left. That's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And having lost everything in my life worthwhile, I was willing to do whatever they told me to do here. And as a result, I got my life back. I say that in jest about being miserable, but it was that which helped me, gave me the tenacity, and it gave me the energy to do what was necessary to stay sober and literally turn my life around. And for that, I am indebted to Alcoholics Anonymous and this group in particular. I am an alcoholic of the type that wouldn't have made it anywhere else. I'm afraid if I would have gotten sober where they would have told me, like when it came time to read my inventory and I didn't want to do it, and they said, well, you know, get a teddy bear and hold it and feel your inner child a little bit, I wouldn't be here tonight. I had to have somebody who would tell me what to do, and I didn't like it. I used to drink, and I liked drinking. I loved everything that alcohol did for me. The way I grew up here, Andy said she grew up west of here, and I grew up around here, and I don't mind you drinking my water, Andy. And I grew up here, and I come from an Irish Catholic family, and I have six brothers and sisters, and it was a good home. It had its problems. I don't know of any family that doesn't. But the way I felt was much like what Cecil talked about. I had that hole in my gut like there was nothing there and the wind was blowing through. When I was new, I heard Clancy say that. And I understood. For the first time, I knew that somebody else felt like I did, because I was a wimp and I was a goober and I was just, I felt weak, and I felt like there was this hole in my gut and I didn't know what was wrong, and I felt like I was born in the wrong century. If I'd only been born in the 18th century when they had morals and convictions, then everything would have been okay, you know? But it was the 20th century that was screwing me up, and I just didn't get along, and I had no friends, and my friends were my friends' parents. I could get along better with them than I could with my own peers, because I knew what a parent wanted to hear. And so I was this dual child. I had this terrible personality and a rotten little kid, but I would just be the little altar boy and sing in the choir and tell your mother whatever she wanted to hear. And they'd go, isn't Robbie just a sweet little boy? You know, and I don't know how sweet I was, but the way I felt, it's not funny, the way I felt, the way I felt was this hole in my gut, and I just felt uncomfortable in my own skin, and I didn't understand what was wrong with me. And why don't I feel like Johnny feels? Johnny's happy, and he has friends, and they're playing on the school ground, they're running around, they're playing tag, and everybody wants to be Johnny's friend. But there was me over there, and I was just this goober. I was like, I was just over there, and I wasn't doing much, you know, and I just felt completely alone, and I couldn't play sports, and I always say this, and this is the way it felt. I don't even think this happened, but it's the way it was felt. We would have little teams at school, and I never got picked to be on those teams. You know, it was always, well, you take Robert. No, we had him last week. No, you take him this week. We'll take him twice next week. You know, that's the way I felt inside. And what happened for me when I was 12 years old, my cousin got married, and I got into the beer and the champagne. And as I drank that champagne and that beer, I came alive. Something magical happened, and all of a sudden I stopped thinking about myself, and I stopped thinking about how I felt all the time. And all of a sudden I found myself running around this house, and my cousins were chasing me. I was chasing my cousins, and I was laughing, and it was fun. I didn't care what anybody thought about me. I didn't care about my Catholic parents and what they were going to say. I was just having fun, you know, and it felt good. And that feeling was with me every time I drank. And it made me feel like you have been feeling all your life. Or that's what I thought. By the time I was 18 years old, my father said to me one time, he says, you know, Robert, just because somebody offers you a drink when we go to the cousins, or we go to your aunt and uncle's, or we go to my parents' house, you don't have to take the alcohol, a drink. You can turn it down. You know, I thought my father was trying to teach me to be polite. He didn't understand. I liked what it did to me. It gave me the ability to talk to people. It gave me the ability to be somebody I wasn't. Because without alcohol, I am nothing. I feel like I'm a piece of garbage. I have nothing to say. I don't know how to talk to you. And I just feel like a goober, creep, no good, nothing. You know, I feel like a mistake. You know, I feel like an abortion that lived. You know, that's how I felt. And but when I have alcohol, man, I come alive. And I can get on the bar stools in the bar in Butte, Montana and dance and try to climb out of moving cars. Or I pretend I'm Evel Knievel and I try to jump my car over rivers and my car lands in the middle of the river and I just think it's funny as my car is sinking. Those were fun times. I had a lot of fun like that, you know. But the problem was that alcohol would only fix it for a while. So I would go to the Baptist church and I became a Baptist, you know, for a while, which is really funny. I had a crush on this guy who was getting married to this girl, so I followed him to the Baptist church. I don't know what I was thinking, you know, but it came time to get dunked, to be baptized in the Baptist church, and I'm a little psychotic, and all of a sudden I began to think, well, what if the Catholic God's the real God, and he doesn't like the Baptist God, you know, and so I didn't get baptized that day. I walked out instead, and then I tried Est. I went to Est, and I became a little Werner Erhard Jr., you know, and I was estetizing all my friends. And that came to an end when a good friend of mine, put a knife to my throat, and he says, if you tell me one more time it's nice for me to share, I'm going to kill you, you know, and I came that close to saying, thank you for sharing, you know, and I thought, he doesn't understand, you know, and I would go and I'd have physicals, and I would literally be in tears when they would say, there's nothing wrong with you, you're a healthy 21-year-old boy, you know, you're doing good, you're going to live a long life. And I remember walking out in tears. I was depressed, because I was hoping they could tell me that I had some weird brain disease, some tropical cancer they had never heard of before, and I was the first one ever in the world to contract this disease, you know, and that would explain why I felt so different, you know. And they would just say, there's nothing wrong with you, you're a healthy kid, you know. And by the time I was 24 years old, I ended up in the Valley, and that's not a nice place, and it brought me to my knees, what can I say, you know. Try it, see what happens to you, you know. And things got really weird out in the Valley, and I won't go into a lot of those details, but it got very weird out in the Valley, and I can tell you this much, I was drinking every day, and I was getting drunk, and I was going to the grocery store. I was 24 years old, I lived alone, I had bought this house. All right, the truth is I embezzled the money from my dying grandmother to buy this house. And my mom thought that I was a sweet boy. And see, this mixed personality that I've lived with all my life, I embezzled the money from my grandmother's estate and I bought this house. And I used to drink. And I would, every morning, I would go out to my car, and I'd walk out into the driveway, and I'd walk around my car, and I was looking for pieces of skin, I was looking for pieces of clothing, maybe a shoe, maybe some blood, maybe a dent in the car, because I couldn't remember how I got home the night before. And I can only describe it as this terror was in my gut as I'd go outside, and I would pray, dear God, please, please, let me not have hit anybody on the way home last night. Please, you know. And I'd walk around that car with that terror in my gut. And I'd get around that car and I'd think, I didn't hit anybody. And the next thought was, well, maybe they bounced off the bumper of your car, you know. And maybe they didn't leave a dent in your car. And my mind would just start spinning. And I was very bizarre. I was sitting at home on a Friday night playing the records on the record player. Hank Jay was the first speaker I heard in AA, and he talked about this, playing the same song on the radio over and a record player over and over and over and over. And I mean, you get a good song like Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. Man, I could sail through a whole evening on that one song. And I'd be sitting in this rocking chair. I had taken the cross off the wall. I'd be holding it in my lap, drunk as all hell. And my eyes would be closed, and then I'd be just sobbing as I watched the procession of people walking by my open casket, weeping by the way they had treated me my whole life, you know. And that was Friday night at my house. That was fun. I was stealing my next door neighbor's sprinkler. You know, I was 24 years old, I would steal her sprinkler, and I would go outside and I would get naked and I would do things that naked people outside do, and it was just very, those are hard to explain, you know, and By the time I had done everything that we do here, you know, I know how to drive with one hand over my eye to, you know, solve the double lane problem, and I know how to put my foot on the bed to stop that bed from spinning because you're going to throw up, you know, but as soon as you get your foot on that floor, it's like, ah, you know, solve that problem, you know, and it was just pretty hideous living. It was, I was alone, and I was desperate, and I was nuts. And by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I was Jesus Christ. I thought that at 32 years old, I would have my second coming and the world would recognize me for who I was. And boy, would you be sorry for the way you had treated me, you know. And I also thought I was, I tell all these stories and it's just, I know you've heard this before, but this is just my story, you know. And I thought it was a government stress test to see how much stress a human being could take. And then my parents just told me, it's true that my parents had sold me to the CIA as a small child. I, too, felt like I was adopted, you know. In fact, I was in sobriety insisting to my mother she show me my adoption papers, you know. And it was just, I didn't come here well. And the way I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is I had asked this girl to marry me. And I hadn't dated her in a couple of years, but we were out water skiing and I was drunk and it seemed like a good idea at the time. And she says, you know, Robert, I think you have a drinking problem. And I said, what are you talking about? She says, Robert, you've been drinking since 6 o'clock this morning. And I said, Eileen, that is not alcoholism for Christ's sakes. I said, we are on vacation. This is being on vacation. Would you get it together here, you know? And I said, what do you think this is, you know? And then somebody else says, if you drink before 12 o'clock, that's alcoholism. I got news for you. If you're out mowing your lawn and you're drinking and it's 11 o'clock in the morning, that is not alcoholism. That's yard work. Let's call it by what it is, you know. And I had all these rules about what was and what was not alcoholism. And every time I found myself meeting that criteria, I wouldn't stop drinking. You change the criteria. You know, you get a real clear picture. And I would be in the bars and I'd point out and I'd say, man, that guy is an alcoholic. That guy has been in here every single night. That guy is a drunk. You know, and it didn't dawn on me until I came into AA. The only way I knew he was a drunk is because I was there every night watching him, you know. And I wasn't telling anybody what my real name was. And it was, I never want to go back. I never want to go back. And the saddest thing of all is I thought when I was out there that I was living in the light. I thought I had the answers. I thought I was right and you were wrong and the world had wronged me. And my motto growing up until for a while in AA too was I didn't ask my parents to be born. They didn't ask me my permission to bring me in this world. Therefore, I'm not responsible. You figure out my problems, you know. And that was my attitude. And I came to AA because Eileen planted a seed in my head. And I thought she was crazy. And she told me that if I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous for 30 days, that she would reconsider. And I waited 30 days like a good alcoholic. I counted those days. I called her up on the phone. And the first words out of her mouth was, you haven't gone to AA yet, have you? How does she know, you know? And I said no, and I hung up that phone, and I just thought, who wants her anyhow, you know? And what happened is this guy came into Sears where I was working. I was a hip, slick, cool salesman for Sears, you know? I was wearing blue pale polyester nylon suits, leisure suits, and I thought I was cool, you know? And this guy came into my job, and I tried to pick him up is what I did, and I said, well, let's go out and have a drink. And he said, you know, Robert, I used to work with you when you were selling tires and batteries across the parking lot over there, and I didn't know that. And see, I'm the kind of a guy that if I don't want something from you, if I have no use for you, I don't bother getting to know your name. I was 5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and still working at Sears, and I worked up on the third floor, and it hit me one day that I had no idea, I did not know the names of any of the employees on the entire third floor of the Sears store. And I walked by that cash register every single day on my way in and on my way out. And every single day they would all say, lovely ladies would say, good morning, Robert. And I would say, good morning. 5 years sober, I still didn't know any of their names. And that's just the kind of guy I am. So I tried to pick this guy up, and I said, let's go out and have a drink or something. And he said, I don't drink. And I said, what are you, an alcoholic or something? You know. And he says, well, why do you want to know? And the truth was I had called Alcoholics Anonymous, or I actually called 411 that morning because I was late to work. I got in at 1:30 in the afternoon, and they were a little upset about that. And I just thought I overslept, you know. And I said, well, I called 411 and I put the telephone, I called 411 and I got the telephone number to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he lit up like a Christmas tree. And he calls over his wife, Robert called AA, you know, and this is on the sales floor, it's Sears for crying out loud. This is embarrassing, you know, and I began to get sweaty and I just thought, I did not call AA for crying out loud. And he tried to 12-step me right then and there, and he handed me his card. I said, get out. Just get out. You know, and I threw that number away, and I said, I will never, ever, ever tell anybody I have ever called or attempted to call or even thought about calling Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And that was embarrassing. And a month went by, and I went to a birthday party that my family gave for me on September 7th of 1980. And I had gone to church that morning. I said I wasn't going to drink. I'd made that promise. Today I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to swear. I'm not going to smoke any pot. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. And I walked into that party and I saw my brother-in-law across the room. And I'm just going to have one. Just one, so that him and I can talk. Because I couldn't connect with anybody there. I could no longer connect with my own family. And I, of course, like a good alcoholic, I grabbed the bottle of booze out of the living room. I went into the kitchen. I poured the drink so nobody would see. And I was drinking bourbon and seven in those days. Nobody could see it. And I felt okay. And I walked in. And my family said, we thought you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I didn't realize I was pouring the glass was clear. They could see exactly what I was drinking, you know. And I said, I called Alcoholics Anonymous for crying out loud. Get off my back. They told me to drink. Get it out of your system, you know. I don't know where I got that from, you know, but it sounded good, you know, and they didn't know anybody. They just kind of looked at me, you know, and then I went off the deep end, and I just made a fool out of myself, and it was horrible, and I ended up in the swimming pool, and I don't go to the swimming pool unless I'm drunk. I don't go to the grocery store unless I'm drunk. The grocery store is a horrible place to go. You're standing in line, you're in aisle 3, and you got your groceries, and there's some people ahead of you, and you glance at them. And all of a sudden you realize those people are talking about you. And then pretty soon you look behind you and they look at you. And then they go back to talking to their partner and all of a sudden you're thinking, they're talking about me. And by the time I left that grocery store, that entire store was talking about me. And the only way for me to control that is to be drunk. And so I was buying $150 worth of groceries for one person every time I went to the grocery store. You know, it was bizarre. And at that party, I went swimming. And the reason I tell the story is because when I was drinking, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything unless I was drunk. I don't go swimming. I don't go outside. I don't go grocery shopping. I do nothing. I'm the kind of a guy that when I spilled a bottle of vodka in my house one night, I spilled it on its TV trays, which I had this bottle of vodka. I did the only thing any decent alcoholic would do. And to me, to this day, it makes perfect sense. And I'm convinced if you don't think this makes sense, you may be in the wrong room. But I got down and I licked that vodka up. And as I'm down there licking that vodka up, the right side of my head said, Robert, this is not social drinking. You know, and swear to God, the other side of my brain as I'm licking said, if you were as depressed and had a miserable life as I do, you'd be doing this too. You know, and that's the kind of a drunk I am. You know, and I love what alcohol did for me. You know, man, I had some fun. I had a lot of fun with alcohol. But it was also making me do things that I wasn't really proud of. And it was killing me. And I was praying every day to die. Every day I was praying to die. And I would pray the first prayer in the morning is I would cuss out God for not taking me in my sleep. Because I didn't want to face another day. And I was thinking about killing myself on the freeway. I was always thinking of all these dramatic things. And so at this party, I'm drunk and I'm in the swimming pool. And I see my brother-in-laws at the side of the edge of the pool, and they're talking and they're laughing. And I said to myself, and I don't know where this came from, God, I wish I could feel like they feel right now without the use of drugs and alcohol. Now, they had been drinking all day, you know, and one of them was an alcoholic, you know. But I wanted to feel like they felt. And the next thing I know, I passed out, and I went home, and on my way home, I broke out into tears, and I said, God, help me before I kill myself tonight or I kill somebody else. Because this guy was walking in the crosswalk in front of my car, and I made no attempt to miss him. I didn't care. I just didn't care. I hit a pedestrian once before, you know. And I sued him, as a matter of fact, for running into my car, you know. And they had to go to court and tell that. It was so funny. I had to go to a lawyer's office when I got sober and say, I lied about this deposition. I was drinking that night. And I said, I can't get on the witness stand. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was drinking. And it was so sad to see this lawyer look at me with disgust that I had lied. Can you believe that? A lawyer feeling disgusted. I was lying, you know. And I swear to you, this is the truth. I tell him, I was drinking that night. Well, how many drinks did you have? And I said, I don't know. I'm an alcoholic. I said, I was in a bar right before I hit this guy. And he said, how many? I said, well, I think I probably had 3 drinks in the bar. At the top drawer of his desk, he pulls out a sheet of paper and he looks and he goes, well, let's see now. Legally, you can have this much alcohol and you're not really drunk, you know. And he got out the deposition. He said, now let's go through your deposition line by line. And every line he wrote, I said, that was a lie. That was a lie. No, I had done this. And he just finally closed the book and said, never mind. You know, he just, it was horrible, but I had lied about everything. But anyways, at this party and on the way home, I almost hit this guy. And I cried the alcoholic prayer, like I said, God help me before I kill myself tonight or I kill somebody else. I just didn't care. And I don't know why. I went home and I called central office on September 7th of 1980 on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock at night. I called it and a guy by the name of Frank answered the telephone. And Frank tried to talk to me about my drinking and I didn't want to tell him how much I drank. I asked him, I begged this guy, just send me the literature in the mail. That's all I want. Don't you have any pants? Just send me whatever the information is in the mail. And he says, we don't have any literature at central office. Liar. But if you go to a... If you go to a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll find what you're looking for. Why don't I have somebody call you? I don't want anybody calling me. And I wouldn't give them my telephone number. But I was calling the telephone company all the time, complaining there was something wrong with my line because there was no messages when I got home from work. And they said, Mr. Kilgore, we've checked your phone. Well, check it again. You know, I was just, and now I had somebody who wanted to call me, and I didn't want anybody calling me. Don't be bugging me. And then I got a resentment when I got sober that nobody placed a 12-step call on me, for crying out loud. Why do I have to go place a 12-step call on somebody else? And it was about 2 years in sobriety when I realized, I remember this conversation, I said, don't have anybody come and talk to me. I don't want anybody calling me, you know. And he really tried to talk to me on the telephone. He finally said, you know what, do you think you could not drink between now and tomorrow? Well, you think I'm an alcoholic or something? Of course I cannot drink, you know. And he said, well, they have meetings. Where do you live? I said, I live in Reseda, and I don't want to go to meetings there. He said, okay, well, where do you work? I said, I work in Inglewood, and I don't want to go to meetings there, you know. And I wasn't a real... Hi, nice to meet you, kind of drunk, you know. And he said, well, there's a place, it's halfway in between. It's called the Pacific Group. I won't be there, but I really think you should go, you know. And I immediately started thinking about the Pacific Group. I started thinking about West L.A., you know. I thought, West L.A.? Oh, my God, that is a low-class neighborhood. That's a scummy neighborhood. That's like middle income. I don't know where I think I was coming from, you know. I'm out in the backyard doing weird things that even the poor don't do, you know. And I don't know what I was thinking. I got an ego. I swear to you, I could be laying in the gutter. You could walk by and look at me and spit on me, and I'll look back up at you and I'd say, well, at least I'm laying down and I'm relaxing. You know, and no matter what it is, man, I'll find a way to be better than you. Not your equal. I'm either better than you or I'm less than you, but never your equal. And He talked me into going to a meeting, and it was Ohio Street, Monday night, Ohio Street, and the next day I went to Sears, of course, where I go, and I went to work, and in walks this guy who tried to 12-step me 30 days before. And he says, doesn't sound really weird, Robert, he says, but today is my day off, and he said, I'm watching TV. I know this is going to sound weird, but God told me to come and see you, that something happened in your life. And I got goosebumps all over me, and I started to cry, which was to be a pattern in sobriety. I was crying for years in AA. But I started crying right there on the sales floor at Sears, you know. And he took me outside, and he bought me a cup of coffee, and he 12-stepped me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I couldn't believe it, you know. At the snack shop at Sears, I got 12-stepped into AA. And this guy, it turned out, him and his wife had 6 months of sobriety. And what was to happen to them, I don't know. The last I had heard, this is many, many years ago, they had both gotten drunk. But all I know is they handed me the key to sobriety. You know, they handed me the gift of sobriety. And I was not cooperative. The only thing I remember about that entire conversation is, Robert, you don't pick up the first drink. And I said, you don't understand. I never remember picking up the first drink. It's not the first drink. I come to on the fourth drink and go, God, how did I get started one more time? I promised myself I wasn't going to drink today. How did this happen? And he said, Robert, you know, pick up the first drink. And I just didn't get it. And he said, I'll sit on your hands. You call my wife. She'll sit on your hands. We'll do whatever it takes. You don't pick up the first drink. And that's all I remember of the entire conversation. And I told him I was going to go to Ohio Street that night, and I remember driving my car, and I parked on Ohio Avenue. I was looking at that A-frame little building, and I said, I can't go. I can't get out of my car. Man, as soon as I go there, those guys are going to look at me, and they're going to look at me and say, you dirty little fag. And the guys are going to take me, and the women will say, take them out back, and they are just going to pulverize me. They are going to beat me and kick me and then toss me out on the street. And I was scared to death. I mean, scared to death. And I said the second prayer I said in my sobriety, I said, God, help me get in here and get that information. And all of a sudden, I had a little bit of courage. Scared to death, I walked in. I don't remember who was the secretary. All I know is somebody stuck out their hand at the front door. And I said something like, is this like, you know, AA or something? At this Alcoholics Anonymous, and welcome. Come on in and get yourself a cup of coffee, you know. Didn't tell me, get a seat. And I got a list. I got a list of all those resentments, you know. But and I'm standing there back at the cup of coffee, and up comes this guy. He sticks out his hand and says, my name is Rob. You must be new here. How does this guy know? You know, God, there's a lot of people here, you know. And he says, why don't you tell me about your drinking? I said, I drink two beers a day. Two beers a day, pal. Two. That's all. I'm here for literature, you know. And Rob K. was smart. He didn't argue. He says, well, come on over. And he took me to the front of the room where they had the literature. I walked out of that meeting that night, no literature, you know. And he started taking me around the room, and guys started handing me their cards. And I'm thinking, I don't want to sleep with these guys. Why are they giving me their cards? This is disgusting, you know. And they're touching me. They're touching me, and I don't like to be touched. Don't put your hand on my shoulder. And they were patting me on the back, and it was just making me crazy. And he kept taking me along this line of guys who were just standing there, for Christ's sake. They were 30 years old, and they were ugly, and it was just disgusting. And I'm never going to tell my parents I've gone here, you know. And Dave Mackey, Dave M., hands me his card, and he says, you know, pal, we know you pee in the shower. Put my head down, I said, how does this guy know, you know? And I started spinning. I think, man, did I leave my window open one time when I was taking a shower? And man, I was off and rolling. That played right into my psychosis, you know, thinking I was the test of the IRS. And now I'm not eating your cookies. I'm not drinking your coffee because I know they're drunk and you're trying to take over my mind. I know this is a Jim Jones cult. I know it's going to happen, you know, and I wouldn't drink your cookies. I would drink your coffee. I wouldn't eat your cookies. And I told my sponsor, I said, he said, have a cup of coffee. I said, oh, no. This is brainwashing. I know what's going on here. And God bless John Felix and or John F. He said to me, he said, Robert, trust me. You have absolutely nothing we want, okay? And I was so stupid, I didn't get no. I thought, well, that's nice. They don't want my money, you know. And I didn't get he had just insulted me. Another resentment. And I left that meeting that night, and I was mad because Frank told me that you were going to ask me out to coffee. Now, I wasn't the most friendly guy in the world, you know, and I don't blame anybody for not offering to take me to coffee. But on my way home, I was going to get drunk. I was planning that drunk, and when you found out that I got drunk, man, were you going to be pissed off at yourself, you know? You should have treated me better. And all the way home in my little car, I was going to get drunk that night. I don't know why I didn't get drunk that night. I had every intention of drinking at you that night, and I didn't. And I got to tell you, over the years, that's the way I went to meetings. I was angry at meetings, and I wanted to drink. They talked about drinking at meetings made me thirsty, real thirsty, you know, and I just wanted to go home and get drunk because it was painful to be sober. It hurt to be sober. You know, and people say, I feel like I've come home and I feel so good here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't feel so good. And I didn't like people, you know. I told John, I said, I don't like that Clancy guy. Who does he think he is? I said, I hate him. I hate him. And he said, you're to go down to the Midnight Mission, make an appointment with him first, and then go down and tell him how you feel. Okay, fine, I'm going to go down there, you know. And I was scared, you know, but I was going to follow direction, you know. And I went down there, and I was ready. I had my armor on, and I go in there. I was a puke is what I was, you know. And I go in, and I'm all ready. I'm ready to duke it out with this guy, you know. And the first thing I said, he sticks out his hand and welcome. Well, anybody will do that. Even your enemy will shake your hand. And he said, cup of coffee, kid? Let's try to be nice. And okay. Would you like some cream in that? How about some sugar? You take sugar in your coffee? And then the thing that really insulted me, he stirred that coffee, you know, and handed it to me. Is it warm enough for you? What can I do for you? What am I going to say? I hate you? You know, and this is not fair. He does not fight fair, you know, and So I told him, I said, I don't like you. I hate you. I don't like you. And you have a big ego and you're mean. And rah, 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 rah. He sat there. I'll never forget this. I'll never forget this as long as I live. He sat there and he said, do you know why you don't like me, Robert? I said, no. He goes, I'll tell you why you don't like me. You want to be just like me. Man, I was mad now. He knew, you know, and I wanted that power. I wanted that respect, you know, and we formed a friendship, you know, and Clancy saved my life. You know, at 2 years of sobriety, I wanted to commit suicide. And once again, I found myself in his office asking for help from somebody I didn't trust, somebody I was afraid of. And I went down there, and he gave me some direction. And he told me if I ever told anybody what that direction was, he would deny it, so I can't tell you. But he told me what to do, and I didn't commit suicide. It worked. And over the years, I've sought his counsel, and he's always been there for me. And the most touching thing the man has done for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is not about him, but thinking about talking has made me go through the years of my sobriety, and I had to come out as a gay man in sobriety. I had tried dating women. That was fun. My first date in AA was a crack-up, and I'll never forget this. The time it came to consummate our dating relationship, I was like 90 days sober, and I was scared. I was so scared. I didn't know what to do, you know? And I told my sponsor, he said, you don't worry about a thing, Robert. I'll be right outside her apartment. If anything goes wrong, I'll be right there, you know. And I opened up the drapes, and there was John, you know. And I thought, man, these people in AA, they care. They care, you know. And what I've done here in Alcoholics Anonymous is I work the steps. You know, the steps, the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear about it during the Secretary's announcement, is what has the program of AA in it. Part of what we're doing here tonight is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the steps are what offered me my recovery. And part of my story was the third step prayer, which changed my life. I was 5 years sober, and I had to deal with the fact that it turns out I'm gay. That's just the way God made me, and I didn't want to be that way. But I got on my knees, and I took the third step prayer, and I offered my life to God, as it says to do in the big book. And I said, all I ask you to do is to make me be of service to you and my fellow man, and help me not to kill myself one day at a time, and I will give you my life in exchange. And I did that at 5 years of sobriety, and I've never looked back. It was the best decision I made because it allowed me to live in my skin. And I've gone through a lot in sobriety. I went back to school in sobriety. I went to UCLA, and I did very well over at UCLA. I've done a lot of things here in sobriety. I've gone whitewater rafting and skydiving and trips to Europe and trips to New York. And the biggest experience I have, though, is when I'm sitting down with somebody I sponsor. That's the best experience in the world, and I help them. I love to see a guy come into my front door in pain and walk out with a little bit of light and hope in his eyes. I have laid in bed at night sometimes not able to fall asleep because I feel so good. Not the kind of good that feels like, oh, Robert, you're so wonderful. The kind of good that I touched another human being that day and I gave somebody hope. And that has only happened to me maybe two or three times in my sobriety where I've just laid in bed and it was the closest I've felt to God was I felt good. That feeling I've been trying to get all my life with the use of drugs and alcohol. I have walked through the death of my partner who died of AIDS when I was 5 years sober, and I didn't drink. And the amazing thing is, what touched me the most is Clancy came up and gave me a hug after his funeral and said, it's going to be all right. And that made me feel safe, you know. This really is my family here. This is where I grew up. This is where you made it was safe for me to become a man here. Life is good. I also have my share of problems, like the book says, we all do, you know. At 10 years of sobriety, I wanted to commit suicide. I don't know why. I went into depression like I've heard about. I heard Bill Wilson went through one, and I went through a depression, and it was horrible, and I wanted to die. But I didn't stop going to meetings, you know. The interesting thing is the people that have helped me in my sobriety, many of them have gone out, you know. And I had a friend of mine with 8 years of sobriety commit suicide. I've had friends of mine with 8 years of sobriety drink again. I've seen people with 18 years drink again, and it scares me. And I remember when I was new, I heard somebody say this to a podium. It was Clancy. He said, I was sitting over there where I always sat, And he said, look to your right and look to your left, because a year from now, one of them are not going to be here. And it hit me cold in the face. There was two people looking at me. And I thought, it ain't going to be me. It is not going to be me. And I have a good life today. You know, I don't have everything I want. But I got to tell you, I wouldn't trade anything for my sobriety. Take away my home. Take away my health. Take away my family. My mother died last year. I had a commitment to speak at this meeting. I came here a week after she died and spoke because that's what I was asked to do. I did not want to speak here tonight. You guys have heard my story. And it's hard to come up here and tell you about me when you've watched me go through this. When Andy got up here and talked tonight, you know, it's not so much I saw Andy, I saw myself. I saw what a crazy, snotty, angry, resentful, judgmental goober I was, you know. And I remember seeing Andy come in. And I also see her, I see the hope. I saw that she changed, you know. And I then saw the change that's happening in my life. I really want to welcome the two guys. I only saw two guys raise their hands. There may be more out there. All I can tell you is I didn't think I was an alcoholic for many, many years. But I kept coming back in here because I couldn't live out there. And to all of you, to all my friends, to the Pacific Group, to the people that were here before me, to the men and women that have come after and have held my hand and have loved me, I want to say thank you for my sobriety. And to the new people, I hope you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous until the miracle happens in your life as it has in mine. And thank you very much.